Now let's talk about a wonderful subject. The fifth means of growth would be suffering. Others would call this the discipline of the Holy Spirit, God's discipline in your life. I kind of like suffering more because it's more of an umbrella term that could include natural suffering that didn't come from God but He permitted, or it could include direct, active discipline that God has on your life. This is very important. You might say that, you can be a good Christian worker if you're into ministry and the other means of growth. But if you want to be a great Christian worker, you have to be ready and willing to suffer. This separates the men from the boys. The ones who are able to suffer and to persevere through times of trial. No Christian who fails to understand this is going to make it very far. They'll make it to a certain extent. I don't want to exaggerate this point. They'll make it kind of far. Yet there's going to be a certain point, a line in the sand, 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years, where they go through some suffering and all of a sudden the wheels are falling off the bus and you really discover what their character is really like. It's important that we teach this means of growth to new Christians, maybe even pretty soon. I mean, you might even want to talk about this up front, because they could be experiencing all of this excitement and happiness from coming to meet God, and then all of a sudden they get some suffering and they don't know what to do with that. That becomes very confusing and they don't know what that means. And so to prepare them, there is going to be suffering in the Christian life and getting ahead of them on this. The Bible speaks about this often. It uses different imagery, different motifs. Jesus uses the imagery of life out of death, for example. He talks about the seed that goes into the earth. It must die in order to bear fruit. The life out of death principle. The quintessential example is Jesus himself. That he himself died so that he could bring spiritual life to others. Biblical imagery would include the parent-child relationship, which is something that we're becoming increasingly unaware of and disillusioned of in our culture, where discipline for children is seen as something that's actually kind of cruel. This has not been the case in most cultures throughout history or even today. It's really a Western phenomenon that to discipline your kids is an act of cruelty. Read the Proverbs on this, about how if you fail to discipline your son, it means you hate your son. That's what you're saying. You're setting him up for death. Hebrews 12, quoting the Proverbs and in a long discourse, talks about how God wouldn't discipline someone who is not his son. Why would he do that? The fact that we're under God's discipline at times actually proves that we're his children, because God loves those he disciplines. So that'd be imagery. There's also the imagery in 1 Peter 1:7 that all of this suffering that you're going through is there to purify your faith. And the language used there is the language of metallurgy, where someone would heat up, let's say, gold, not to the point where it's just malleable or bendable, but to the point where it's actually liquid, and filling it up to the brim of liquid gold. And through this process of refinement, a bunch of what they call dross goes to the top, and metallurgists will skim off the dross, and then they let the gold cool, or the silver cool, whatever they're working with. Then they heat it up again, and more dross comes out, and they skim it off the top. Well, if you do this enough times, then you're going to have some pure gold. Is it in the Proverbs or in the Psalms, chapter 12, where it says, "The word of the Lord is like metal purified 7 times"? It's basically saying it's heated up and the dross was taken out. Heated up, dross. Basically saying this is pure. The word of the Lord is pure. And the same imagery is used for our faith. When our faith is put under tension, when there's tension put on our faith, all of a sudden those impurities come to the surface in ways we didn't even know it was there. It was down there in our character, and somehow it got raised to the surface, and all of a sudden we're staring at it and all of its ugliness. And to be able to get through this to the other side in faith purifies our faith, strengthens our faith, And you get through enough of these where you see God came through before and he's going to do so again. Paul uses the imagery of comfort in 2 Corinthians 1 and following, 1, 3 and following. God is the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all of our suffering. And he says, so that we can become comforters to others. That's the point. He comforts us, or encourages us is the word, it's parakaleo, to come alongside us, not just to nurture, but to actually help us and lift us out of it and encourage us to move forward so that we can become these kind of people for others. Having a sensitivity to your character. Why is it that certain people, when you come to during times of trial, just the way they speak about the suffering is so sensitive, so engaged, that it's different. Somebody could say the exact same words and they just don't have that kind of sensitivity to them. Then there's also the imagery of the breaking of the outer man in 2 Corinthians 4. Really, 2 Corinthians 2 through 7 is really, a lot of it's about suffering and ministry. And Paul uses this imagery in 2 Corinthians 4 to describe the breaking of the outer man, which is like the flesh, the old self. And the imagery is, according to verse 6, is that God has made this light shine in our hearts so that we could know the glory of God. And so with an opaque, solid piece of pottery, the light could be in there. You just can't see it. So God has put the light into our hearts, but people can't see it. And so what do you need? God is going to take the hammer and the chisel, and he's going to break that pot. And when he does that, that light starts to shine through, the glory of Christ. As you go through suffering, each one of those scars becomes a beacon of light to show the glory of God in your life. Well, if you have enough of these scars and breakings, all of a sudden you're getting light shining all out. You can still see the pottery. I mean, it's still there. It's just for people who have gone through this process and they've come out on the other side, you just see the glory of God shining through them. Really an incredible picture. Here's Watchman Nee. This is from the book, The Release of the Spirit. A short book, maybe 90 pages. I've said if you've read this once, you've read it three times, because Nee just repeats himself over and over just to break down the outer man of the person until they're just like, you're prideful, you're sinful, you're not broken. And you just read it. It's just a constant rebuke. I've read this book about three or four times, and so that means I've read it probably, well, I don't do math, so it's like 100 times I've read it. Anyways, this is what he says here. He says, revival, zeal, pleading, and activity are but a waste of time. As we shall see, there is just one basic dealing which can enable man to be useful before God. Brokenness. To some, the Lord gives a sudden breaking followed by a gradual one. With others, the Lord arranges that they have constant daily trials until one day he brings about large-scale breaking. Boy, is that true. Sometimes it comes on like a Mack truck. Other times it's just that sandpaper in your life. It's like somebody rubbing sandpaper on your skin. It doesn't really hurt until after, 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes. Yow, you start to feel it. And he raises the temperature to the point, how much does he raise it to? Just enough more than you can handle. That's how much. So whatever you could handle out of self-effort, he's going to put an ounce more of pressure to finally break you of self-effort. And he says the timing is in his hand. We cannot shorten the time, though we certainly can prolong it. Oh, I remember reading that and just thinking to myself, that's me. I'm grumbling, I'm complaining, I'm dragging this out. You can't shorten it. God's going to have his way with you. But you can carry this out. He says, in some lives, the Lord is able to accomplish this work after a few years of dealing. In others, it is evident that after 10 or 20 years, the work is still unfinished. And let me tell you, I know people who are in this category. They've been walking with God for 20, 30 years, still haven't been broken. And it's just apparent to everyone in their lives. They just still haven't learned. And he says, you may learn 10 years' lessons in 1 year, or take 20 or 30 years to learn 1 year's lessons. Oh, that'd be terrible to realize God's been trying to get at an issue in your life, and you've been delaying this. He says our emotions are also a very hard shell. Many who desire to be happy cannot express joy, or they may wish to weep, yet they cannot. For the stoic, for the person that just can't show passion when somebody comes to Christ, the person who is the stiff upper lip when people are weeping and they're grieving, they can't show it. Why not? He says, if the Lord has stricken our outward man, we are able to express joy or sorrow as is inwardly dictated. No one is equipped to work simply because he has learned some teachings. The basic question is still, what kind of person are they? Can one whose inner workings are wrong, but whose teaching is right, supply the need of the church? No. How often our prayers for blessings are actually raising up barriers? How long we long for blessing, yet seem to find God's mercy in crushing experiences? How often when the Lord deals with us, we see only the hand of man? Yeah, we're going through some suffering or some discipline, and we keep thinking, it's his fault. It's her problem. If only I could get out of this house here, man, with all these selfish people. If only this person would stop holding me back. And we keep thinking about this like it's horizontal, when it isn't. The Lord's hand is on you, and you refuse to recognize it. And he says this is entirely wrong. We must remember that it is God who is dealing with us, not our brother or sister or any other person. Has the Lord for years disciplined us, but instead of recognizing his hand, we blamed it on other people or on fate? Oh, may we have the grace to recognize the meaning of his hand in seeking to shatter this outward man. Oh, is that a good book? Not as good as The Normal Christian Life, which I'm going to plug again. But man, that is a really, really good book. Well, let's think about this subject of suffering. Really, when you think about it, our suffering is less than most. You talk to people, what have you been suffering with lately? Well, you know, I was trying to share my Christian convictions with people and they got angry with me. Huh. How about the story I just read of a young woman who converted from Islam and her brother lit her on fire and tore out her tongue? Yeah. Well, we haven't experienced suffering like that. Yeah, we do experience suffering. It is very real. We're pampered, and yet we face it. For one, living in a fallen world. I mean, just living in a world of cause and effect. That's going to cause suffering. A lot of my suffering I've gone through has been from my own sin. Peter says, let none of you suffer as a murderer or a troublesome meddler, being antagonistic, being lazy. I had a roommate who was in his late 20s. He came back. Oh, I'm suffering so bad. What happened, man? I think the Lord is just putting me through some suffering here. Discipline. What is it? Oh, I got fired from my job again, man. Wait a minute. The job at the pizza shop? Yeah. The one you show up late to every day? Yeah. Yeah, that's not the Lord putting you through suffering. That's you putting you through suffering. You're a fool. Read the Proverbs. You're a fool. You're lazy. And a lot of my suffering I've gone through has been from sin. Kind of a good promise to think about, 2 Corinthians 1. God is there to comfort us in all of our suffering. Even if it is personal sin, he wants to be there to comfort us and encourage us out of it. Our suffering could include, you know, money, giving our time, giving our energy, staying up late, getting up early. Here's money. I could be using this money to pay off debt. Instead, I'm giving it to the poor. I guess that's a form of suffering. All this time I have, I could be using this to get another degree. I could be using this to work more, have more money. You could view that as suffering. I guess that's true. How about the agony of caring for other people? The one guy I worked with, hated his Christian parents. He was an atheist, a nihilist. He had tried to commit suicide. I finally worked with him, got to the point where he reaffirmed his faith, reading his Bible. We started a little Bible study in his dorm room, started to reach out to some of his friends. He got into prayer, built friendships, got off of drugs. I mean, he was really starting to look good. And then all of a sudden, he went right back into the drug life. And he turned back on me and said, "You're the problem." His father wrote me a 4-page letter addressed to Reverend James Rochford. So right there, I should have known. Oh, man. And it was a 4-page letter about what a Pharisee, evil, terrible person I am. And, man, that hurts. You know, I basically helped this guy get out of a gutter, and then all of a sudden, he turns away, and it's my fault. I remember our group was going out. You know, we'd come off of a Bible teaching. We went out to go bowling. And I remember driving there. It hadn't really hit me, the hurt. But it did on that drive to the bowling alley. I pulled over into the parking lot adjacent, and I just sat there in my car, and I wept. It just kind of caught up with me right there. Man, does that hurt. I poured my heart out to this guy, and he came back and just... I guess that is agony. Rejection, failure. How about the suffering of confusion? Why aren't things happening here, God? Why am I trying? It just isn't working. It's frustrating. That's all suffering. And one of the things to think of here is that when all these things are going wrong, it's easy to feel like we are in the wrong. I don't know if you ever get that sense. That fell apart. This fell apart. That's going wrong. And there must be something wrong with me. According to the Bible, we could be feeling this way not because we're in the wrong, but because we're in the right. That the normal Christian experience should actually be one where we experience suffering. Think of Paul. He says in 2 Timothy 3:12, "All who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted." That is not hyperbole, as some commentators take it. If you want to live godly, that means you're going for God, and you desire it from the heart, you will face persecution. That is a biblical promise. Not one of my favorites, but it is a promise. You'll be persecuted. Luke 9:23, Jesus says, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." The cross was an instrument of shame, an instrument of humiliation, and an instrument of torture. And Jesus says, you got to pick this up daily to follow him. 1 Peter 4:12, "Do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering." Isn't that the go-to? I'm surprised. Why am I surprised? This is the normal Christian life, that we will face suffering. Don't be surprised, as though something strange were happening to you. We're Christians. That means we follow after the Christ who died on the cross. That's our Messiah. That's our King, a crucifixion victim. Why are you surprised if you're following him and you're facing suffering? Well, some things to keep in mind here when you go through suffering. One of these bits of wisdom comes from Pastor Chuck Smith. He said, "Never trade what you don't know for what you do know." I thought that was pretty wise to hear. You know, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4:8, going through suffering, he says, "I feel perplexed, but not despairing." This is a play on words here, actually. The word for perplexed is apareo. It means to be perplexed. It means to be in a confused state of mind. It's confusing. Why am I going through this? Why now? Why her? Why him? I don't know. But, he says, it's not crossing over the threshold into despair. Ex apareo. To be at a loss psychologically. In other words, you can be in confusion or you can be out of confusion. That your fundamental foundation is from apareo, ex apareo. That there's just no foundation. There are no answers. How horrific to imagine going through life of suffering with no ultimate answers. That this is never going to be justified. It's purposeless. It has no meaning. It's just chemicals colliding with other chemicals. And that's the end of it. That would be what we would call despair. Not having any answers. The Christian view is that we do have ultimate answers of where evil came from, how it will be resolved, and how we can deal with it in the present. And yet we don't have answers to the specific suffering we go through. This was the sin of Job's counselors. They were trying to not just answer the question, why is there evil in the world? They were trying to answer the question, why are you experiencing suffering? And I've had people say, why did I go through this? My answer is, I don't know. It's very mysterious, it's very complex, very perplexing, I don't know. What I do know is, I'm not going to trade what I know for what I don't know. And what I know is that God is going to use this for the good. I know that. If we decide to love God and to stay called according to His calling and His purpose, I can bank on the fact God will use this. I do know that God is going to comfort me during this time. He promises this. In fact, in 2 Corinthians 1:4, he kind of paints this dichotomy here. The more we suffer for Christ, the more God will shower us with His comfort through Christ. Thinking of it as a line graph, that the more I suffer, the more comfort I get from God. And I can bank on that. Of course, Billy Graham once said, God doesn't comfort us to make us comfortable, but to make us comforters to other people. So I know that the comfort and the encouragement of God is going to come into my life, and then God is going to use this somehow, I don't know how yet, to comfort other people. I also know that God is going to right every wrong. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. Some people say, well, that's so violent, that's so not loving. Actually, this is a verse which serves as the basis for forgiveness for the believer. If we'd ever felt like the scales of justice were going to be answered and balanced, if we never felt like people were actually going to face judgment, we would be very prone to getting vengeance for ourselves. Paul says no. He says, if it's possible for you, be at peace with all men, knowing that God is going to judge fairly and righteously. I do know that God is grieved over this. What are the things that we really want when we're going through suffering? I would suggest two. One is we want to have the knowledge of why this happened. And two, we want the power to be able to fix it. I wish I could have been there to stop it. I wish I could fix it. I wish I knew why this tragedy occurred. Aren't those the two things we want the most? Jesus showed up to the tomb of Lazarus, and He had both of those. He knew why Lazarus had died, and He knew that He was going to raise him in 5 minutes. But you know, the really odd part about this account is that even though Jesus knew why Lazarus died, and even though He had the power to raise him from the dead, He still wept. If you have had a loved one die, how much would you weep if you knew that you could raise him from the dead in 5 minutes? I don't think I'd weep that much. Jesus goes to the friend of a loved one, Lazarus, and he weeps so profusely that the people around him say, look at how he loved this man. So what this communicates to me is that God doesn't grieve less than us at suffering, but actually grieves more. And we can know that. We can also know that God will never forsake us. When we go through suffering, we never have to wonder, oh, God must be against me here. We never have to worry about that. Sometimes it's good to wonder, you know, if God actually sat down and told me why I'm going through this suffering, it probably would sound something like this. James, you're going through this suffering because it's going to bring about a really good character transformation in you in about 18 months. And then eventually that's going to lead you to having a really good conversation with another person. And then they're going to become an incredible Christian worker. And that will change the course of their life. And then eventually they will become, you know, leading hundreds of people to Christ. And it's all because of this suffering right here. If God gave you that answer, would that make you more or less grieved? I could very well see people saying, screw that. I don't care what it's going to do for those people. Actually, hearing the intellectual answer could make us more angry than before. What we want is both the intellectual answers, but also the comfort. To know God is with us. He's here with us. He's not some cold, calloused robot who's giving us and printing out all the data on why we're suffering, but he's here with us and he loves us and he's comforting us. We need to recognize God's sovereignty in suffering. Sovereignty means that God can do as he pleases. It doesn't mean that he's in meticulous control or causing everything that happens in the universe. He has a directive will where he causes things, and he has a permissive will where he allows things to happen. And that's as he pleases. That's what a sovereign does. A sovereign king could control all of the people in his land, or he could be a sovereign by letting people do what they want. He would be no less sovereign. Doesn't take away from his sovereignty at all. When we go into suffering, one of the problems is we aren't seeing this through the lens of faith. That actually God either caused this to happen, like when it comes to discipline, or he permitted it to happen when it comes to evil and suffering. So to us, we feel like it's just circumstantial. You know, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, or it was accidental. And really, there's no accidents when it comes to God. The way I like to think of it is, he signed off on this. He didn't cause it, but he signed off and permitted it. And we need to come to grips with that. Why? Because this is integral to being able to get through suffering. Think about Matthew 4. Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Mark's version is even more aggressive. It says that the Spirit dragged Jesus into the wilderness to be tempted. He brought him into a situation to be tempted. That's God's sovereignty. Jesus got there, he whooped on Satan, and then sent him running. He fled, and that was the outcome of it. But God led Jesus into this. How about Ephesians 3:1? I, Paul, the prisoner of who? If I was in prison and I was Paul, I'd be thinking I'm the prisoner of the religious authorities and their false accusations. I'm the prisoner of the Roman guard. I'm the prisoner of Nero. Paul says, no, if I'm sitting here in this prison and I'm wearing these chains, these must be the chains of Jesus Christ. He must have permitted this to happen, put me here for a reason. God is sovereign in suffering. And when we start to see this, we realize that if God permitted this, there must be some reason for it. He doesn't waste suffering. He wants this to have some kind of a purpose. Our role is to cooperate with what God is doing through suffering. Jesus says in John 12:24, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone, but if it dies, it bears much fruit. God wants to use this process of the discipline of the Holy Spirit, of suffering, to break us. The language here is used of actually dying to yourself, so that through your death to self, you can bring fruit into other people's lives. James 1:3, the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Oh, that passage bothered me for a lot of years. Lacking in nothing? Perfect and complete? What is he saying here? He can't be talking about sinless perfection, obviously. James 3, he says, we all stumble in many ways. So what's he talking about? It must be that as you go through suffering, your worst fears are realized. And yet you realize just as clearly, God was here with me. And that big boogeyman, that scary thing that I was just worried about happening, I finally went through it and I came out on the other side, and now I realize I have no needs. I don't need anything. I kept thinking I needed that, and then now it's gone. I needed that, and now it's gone, and now I realize it was taken away. As one author put it, it's the man who can realize that he doesn't have anything, but because he has God, he lacks nothing. 2 Corinthians 1:8, Paul says, we were burdened excessively beyond our strength so that we wouldn't trust in ourselves but in him. What a verse. It's kind of like that idea, God will never give you more than you can handle. It's kind of like that. No, it's kind of not like that. It's kind of not like that at all. In fact, I don't think we should ever say that. God will never give you more than you can handle. Burdened excessively beyond our strength. That's what we would call more than you can handle. What we shouldn't say is, God will give us more than we can handle, but that he will never give us more than he can handle. God will give us more than we can handle, excessively more, beyond our strength, but he will never give us more than he can handle. We get that from the rest of the verse, so that we would not trust in ourselves, but in him. So it's this excessive suffering to the point where I realize, I can't do this. I'm putting up the white flag here. I surrender. I can't do it. And it's at that point that you stop trusting in self and you start trusting in him. Signs that you wouldn't be trusting in God during times like this would be self-pity. As a Christian, pitying yourself, that is not a sign that you're trusting in God. Far from it. You are the most blessed person on earth. And to sit there with an attitude of, oh, this is just so awful, pitying yourself. Closing your heart to people. Becoming numb to people. Functioning through it. For the functioner, the Marthas among us, that just work, 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 and we just function right through it. That's a sign that you still haven't learned the lesson. Burdened excessively beyond our strength. So we learn not to trust in ourselves, but in him. We got to quit the functioning and start to realize, God, you're trying to teach me something here. A flagrant sign of not trusting in him would be that you run for it. You're a runner. I have seen this so many times, it breaks my heart. To see people where they face suffering and then they throw in the towel. This is where they run off for some kind of a sex affair, drugs, career, whatever it is, and they just give up. And they're a runner. And they can run, but the pain is still there. Nothing changes. It only gets worse. Another sign would be that you're turning to illegitimate pain reducers. Like for you, I don't know what you go to. You know, it could be drugs, could be alcohol, sex, Netflix, big tub of ice cream. I don't know what you turn to, but you do. You know what you turn to. And what's happening here is God is trying to get us past the point where we are trusting in self, and it could be right at that point where we're learning to trust in him, that we're pulling the eject lever and we're opting out because we're not actually experiencing the pain. And he's right there on the other side, and we're jumping out of the ship right when he's trying to teach us the lesson, to see it through, and becoming numb to the pain. We need to cooperate during these times. It's not whatever kills me makes me stronger, as Nietzsche said. Not true. I've seen so many people suffer. They become bitter as anything. And yet you see other people suffer and they become more joyful as anything you've ever seen. 2 Corinthians 12:7, to keep me from becoming conceited because of these surpassingly great revelations, there was given me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. There was given me. There's no subject here in the sentence. It doesn't say that God gave it to him. But it does say a messenger of Satan. It could be that God permitted Satan to come in here and to torment Paul. What's the thorn in the flesh? If you figure it out, let me know. I've read, you know, half a dozen commentaries on it. Nobody knows. They all repeat the same things. You know, it could be an eye problem, who knows? We don't know. Whatever it was, God gave him this thorn so that he wouldn't become prideful. Charles Spurgeon was the great 19th century British Bible teacher. He was so popular that whenever Spurgeon would preach on a Sunday, the New York Times would have his sermon on the front page Monday morning. Times have changed. Wouldn't you say? Anyhow, Spurgeon was a big bat. I mean, he was a heavy hitter, led thousands to Christ. He was also a man who suffered from intense depression. There's records from his biographers of him just bursting into tears every hour. His wife was physically handicapped for 27 years of their marriage. He was a big man. If you see paintings of him, he was a big guy, barrel chest. And he would lift her up and carry her up and down the stairs. And because of his fame and he was so influential, many of the other Christian pastors in America at the time, in Britain, they were very critical of Spurgeon. They hated him because all these people were coming to Christ under his ministry. They're jealous. And so he had all this hate mail, accusation. His wife collected all of the hate mail and accusation and put it in a room. And Spurgeon said, "Why did you do that?" And she said, "Because anytime you get prideful, I want you to go and look at this." I wouldn't suggest doing that, but here's what he says. He says, "Those who are honored of their Lord in public have usually to endure a secret chastening or to carry a peculiar cross, lest by any means they exalt themselves and fall into the snare of the devil." This could be something from your past. It could be abuse. It could be a physical ailment that is just not going away. It could be something that you struggle with, and it seems like it's pretty germane to you. It's you struggle with it in ways that other people don't. It's not a sin habit, but something in your life that God, you've pled with him to take away, and he just won't take it away. And Spurgeon's view on this, as a man who suffered intensely, was that God uses this to keep us from pride. And so when we start to look at the influence we're having on people, we don't develop a big head, because he says that would get us to fall into the snare of the devil, to read our newspaper clippings, so to speak, to wonder what people are thinking of us. He says God actually uses this to keep us humble. Chuck Colson used to say to young pastors, he said, the one thing you don't ever want to do is read your own mail. Because Chuck Colson would get letters from people saying, "Chuck, your sermon on this changed my life. Chuck, your book changed this. Chuck this, Chuck that, Chuck." And he said he was reading that, and he just felt like that's more praise than any human is able to withstand. That praise does not belong to man. That praise belongs to God. And you actually have to be able to take it and in your heart give it over to the throne where it belongs, because that's just going to snap you in half. Well, Paul concludes here. He says in verse 10, "I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. All of these different descriptions, weaknesses, insults, distress, I mean, everything. He's just saying any kind of suffering, I'm well content. Eudikeo means to look happy, to feel fine. Why? Because he felt like whatever God had permitted to come into his life made him weaker. And because he realized that he's a weak man, that allowed God's power to surge through him in ways that wouldn't have been possible before. It isn't enough to merely endure suffering. I guess that's what we're arguing here. We need to learn to give thanks during suffering. And Paul was all about this, as we've studied before. He was just always giving thanks, Ephesians 5:20. He gave thanks in everything, 1 Thessalonians 5:18. He even talks about developing an attitude of thanksgiving, Colossians 4:2. Not just that you're giving thanks, but it's the attitude, the propensity that when I turn to God in prayer, the first thing I think of is, thank you, God, for another day. Thank you for these friendships. Thank you for this great life. And we could be on solid ground in saying that someone has really not passed the test of suffering if they haven't learned how to give thanks. To be able to get to the point where you seek contentment, that you're not striving, that, yes, you want to change your circumstances. I get it. And you might even try to do that, and yet you're able to be content in your current circumstance. Not feeling like you have to go for more, but even if you do go for more, I'm happy where I'm at right now. Giving thanks to God for what is going to come out of this trial. We can actually thank Him in advance, saying, God, I thank you that this is going to have some cause for good in the lives of other people. An eternal weight of glory that's waiting there. Thank you for that. And then remember when you're going through suffering that you're not alone. Hebrews 13:5 says that God's with us. Never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. So we can say with confidence, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? You see the connection. He's saying if God is with me, He's never leaving, He's never forsaking, why am I afraid of men? There's no reason to be afraid. 1 Corinthians 10:13, no temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. That's one of the things is when you're going through suffering is you constantly feel like nobody gets it. And you know, that's true. Nobody does get it. Not the way that you're going through it. I hate hearing people say, well, you know, I lost a loved one, so I get it. No, you don't. You didn't have the same relationship that I did. You didn't have the same connection that I did. You get something, but you don't get it. But to know that it's common that other people are going through this with me. It's not just me. 1 Peter 5:9, resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. What is it about knowing that it's not just me going through the suffering, but actually for 2,000 years there's been Christians going through suffering, and I'm not the only freak here that's suffering, but the cause of Christ is being proliferated throughout the world. And there's people all over the world that are going through what we're going through. Came across this excerpt from a pastor from Early Rain Reformed Church. He's a Chinese pastor. He was a human rights attorney. He was a lawyer. He was one of China's public intellectuals until he came to Christ in 2005, which is right around when I came to Christ. And so something about his story kind of resonated with me hearing that. Not all the human rights, public intellectual thing, but we came to Christ about the same time. And this pastor was arrested with 100 of his people in his church because they were doing a prayer meeting in China. Him, his wife, and 11 others are still without communication and have never seen a lawyer. That is written in the New York Times March of 2019. That was only a couple months ago. They still haven't seen a lawyer. No one's heard from him. And Wang Yi, Pastor Yi, knew this was coming. And so he drafted a letter, quote, to be published by the church after 48 hours of detention. He says, if they ever come for me, take me, and you haven't heard from me for 2 days. I want this to be published. Here's his letter. He says, all acts of the church are attempts to prove to the world the real existence of another world. If God decides to use the persecution of this communist regime against the church to help more Chinese people to despair of their futures, to lead them through a wilderness of spiritual disillusionment, and through this to make them know Jesus, if through this he continues disciplining and building up his church, then I am joyfully willing to submit to God's plans, for his plans are always benevolent and good. This happens to be the very reason why the communist regime is filled with fear at a church that is no longer afraid of it. Those who lock me up will one day be locked up by angels. Those who interrogate me will finally be questioned and judged by Christ. When I think of this, the Lord fills me with a natural compassion and grief toward those who are attempting to actively imprison me. Pray that the Lord would use me, that he would grant me patience and wisdom, that I might take the gospel to them. Separate me from my wife and children, ruin my reputation, destroy my life and my family. The authorities are capable of doing all of these things. However, no one in this world can force me to renounce my faith. No one can make me change my life, and no one can raise me from the dead. They did take his family away. He's got a young son who's being raised by his 74-year-old mother. Dad is gone. Yeah, it's not looking bright for him. But that attitude of militants, you can take this away, you can take that away, but no one is going to stop me from preaching the gospel. We want to forsake the urge to protect ourselves, to numb ourselves, and to run from suffering. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 11:28, there is the daily pressure on me of concern for all the churches. The word concern there is anxiety. It comes from the Malay group, Maramanao. Maramana here. He felt suffering from ministry. This is at the culmination of a list of, you know, whippings and beatings and being shipwrecked and persecuted. And then at the end he says, there's the daily pressure of anxiety for the churches. This isn't an anxiety based on yourself and how you're going to look. This is an anxiety based on, I'm concerned for them. How do we know that? He says in verse 29, who is weak and I do not feel weak? Who is led into sin and I do not inwardly burn? To see people that you love losing it, yeah, that causes anxiety, inward burning. To keep your heart open, compassionate, not numbing yourself, to weep with those who weep, as Paul puts it, Romans 12:15. Our culture just doesn't get this, the idea that you would continue to move towards something that is painful. For us, we want to close off, you know, with a nice set of couches, a big screen TV, close the blinds. We not only don't want to talk to our neighbors, we don't even want to see our neighbors. I don't know if you've read the book Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. He said that, you know, houses in the 50s all had big front porches. A lot of your houses are probably that way. Big front porch. Why was that? Because in the 50s, people wanted to see each other. So after dinner, after work, the family would sit out on the porch and you talk to your neighbors. Now, how are all the houses being built? Tiny front porch, big back deck with a privacy fence that goes up 18 feet so you don't even have to look at your neighbor or come into contact with them. That's our culture. We don't want to be involved with people's problems. You could run, you can hide. Here's C.S. Lewis, though. He says, love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly be broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, unredeemable. The alternative to tragedy, or at least to the risk of tragedy, is damnation. The only place outside of heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers and perturbations of love is hell. A profound statement. To protect yourself, you're going to avoid one set of suffering, and yet you're going to be inviting in a whole nother set. A hardened heart, a lonely life, friendless. That's just not the way. Watchman Nee says, there is much suffering we can avoid if we wish, but if we are to be of use to the Lord, it is a fundamental necessity that we make a deliberate choice of the path of suffering for His sake. Unless we acquire a disposition to suffer for Him, the work we do will be of a very superficial quality. Which brings us to our conclusion for tonight. Really, when we think about this pretty ominous subject of suffering, you know, really, it's the fear of suffering that's the worst. You talk to war vets, and they always say it was the lead up to the war. The war itself was traumatic, but the waiting, the fear, the intensity of that, that's really the scariest part. Sickening. And really, thinking in advance of the suffering you could face or might face, it really only makes it worse. It doesn't really help. When we go through suffering and we groan and we complain, it only makes it worse. It only prolongs it. We never learn anything from it. We don't grow from it. We just groan. Here's the key. We can't make suffering happen. It's not like, obviously, we're going out looking to suffer. That's not how it works. God allows it in our lives when He allows it. The way I want you to think about this is this. We need to capitalize on suffering when it arises. The next time you go through suffering, if there's one thing you can remember here, it's this. The next time you go through suffering, think of this as, here's an opportunity to cash out on an opportunity God's giving me. And you could miss it. But if you can actually righteously persevere in thanks, growing close to the Lord through this, you come out on the other side changed in ways you wouldn't believe. And so, a final question confronts us. Have you made the deliberate decision to suffer for Christ, no matter what? When I made the second decision, April 19th, 2005, I was like, I'm in here with you, period. I'm sticking in here till the end. And we might worry, you know, what if this happens? What if that happens? We don't need to worry about that, because when we get there, what we're going to discover is God is going to be there with us. We don't need to worry. But our choice is, are we going to deliberately decide, I'm in with you. I'm not going to run. I'm not going to flee. I've decided I will pick up my cross.